Welcome to Community Presbyterian Church Sermon Podcast for Sunday, May 1st, 2016. The Reverend Ron McHattie is preaching. The sermon today is Encounters with the Resurrected Christ. The gospel reading for today is John 21, verses 18 through 25.
Well, this morning I invite you to pick up with me where we left off 2 weeks ago. On the shore, the northern shore of the Sea of Galilee or the Sea of Tiberias, two different ways of referring to it. And I just want to do a quick summation of the passage that we looked at last week. It's on the beginning of your sermon notes for this morning. We were in John 21, and in the first three verses, we saw seven of the disciples returning to northern Galilee. Four of them we knew were fishermen for sure, and they had returned to their boats and had resumed fishing. Verses 4 through 8, we discovered that they had had an extremely frustrating night. They had caught nothing. And just to remind you, the reason why they were fishing at night is because that's when the temperature of the Sea of Galilee begins to drop. The fish come from the bottom of the waterways and rise to the top where they begin feeding. During the daytime, you wouldn't even know there was a fish in the entire lake. But they had had that frustrating night. Jesus shows up on the shore, encourages them to throw their nets on the other side, takes them back to a previous time, very early when they first interacted, or a couple of them first interacted with Jesus, and their nets were filled to brimming. They brought in their haul of fish. I think it was 153, if I remember right. And the reason for that number is that there is no reason for that number except that the fishermen at that point in time had a practice that when they brought it in, they would count out the number of fish, divide it by the number of fishermen who brought in the catch, and then that's how they supported themselves and fed themselves and their families. Then they're invited to have breakfast with Jesus in verses 9 through 14. And in the midst of that time of having breakfast together, Jesus, beginning in 15, begins that dialogue with the Apostle Peter with those three wrenching questions, Peter, do you love me? So that's where we pick up, and now we're in verse 18, and Jesus is speaking. He says, "Verily, very truly, I tell you, when you were younger," he's speaking to Peter again, "you used to fasten your belt and go wherever you wish, but when you grow old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will fasten a belt around you and take you where you do not wish to go." And then it goes on to say that this was in reference to how Peter was going to die. He was not going to die of natural causes. He was not going to die on his agenda. He was going to be a prisoner. And as if you know your history well, during the reign of Nehru, Peter was crucified. When he found out the means whereby he was going to die, his one request was, put the cross upside down. I'm not worthy to be crucified in the same manner that Christ was. Then it goes on, and he says to Peter, follow me. In that very first fishing incident, that's also how Jesus brings that incident to a close. He says to Peter, follow me, I'll make you fishers of men. And now, again, he's saying, follow me. It's kind of a way of saying to Peter, or reinstating Peter in a sense of calling, even though Peter and the other disciples really have no concept at all about what this is going to mean for them. This next part is one of my favorite parts in Scripture because it's so human. Peter turned, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved, that's John, the one who's writing this account, following them. He was the one who had reclined next to Jesus at supper and had said, Lord, who is it that is going to betray you? When Peter saw him, that being John, he said to Jesus, Lord, what about him? Isn't that great? Isn't that just like all the rest of us? Here, Peter has not gotten the best news from Jesus. You know, you're not going to die on your own terms. The cost of following me is going to be very, very costly. And Peter turns around and says, so what about this guy back here? What's going to happen to him? Now, the response that Jesus gives, this is great. Whenever, you know, some of you know that every once in a while, you know, I have a tendency to make a comeback on a remark. I don't do it intentionally. It just happens. It's just the way I'm wired. And sometimes it catches you a little bit by surprise. You know, is he serious? Is he not serious? Is he joking? Is he not joking? So I really love Jesus' response. A little slight paraphrase here. So Peter, what is it to you? That's basically what he's saying here. If it's my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? Now, that little phrase in there is real important about how rumors spread through the early church. That little phrase got picked up by the early church, and many in the early church believed that that meant that John was never going to die a physical death, that he would be alive when Jesus returned. It's not what Jesus said. It's all hypothetical. He's basically saying to Peter, you know, we're talking about you right now. We're not talking about John. Don't distract me. And he brings Peter right back on track again. He finishes it by saying, follow me. Follow me. That's what you're supposed to be focused on. What does it mean for you to follow me? Not John, not Andrew, not any of one of the other disciples. We're focused on you right now, Peter. Follow me. When I read this passage of Scripture, two questions, more than two questions come to my mind, but two of them that came to my mind, I jotted down for you. How often are each of us guilty of comparing ourselves to someone else? We do that all the time. And it's not to our benefit. We not only do it in our walk of faith, we're probably more mindful of it in all the different arenas of life. I mean, if you take whatever your occupation was or your occupation currently is, or if you were a parent actively watching your kids grow up, I mean, there's always this kind of comparison going on. I mean, it happens at a very, very young age. We just had an incident in our family where our granddaughter, who's 8, had an overnight at their house, and 3 or 4 of her best friends were there, and they had a wonderful evening together. But the girl that she was closest to in their group made it very clear to our granddaughter that her bedroom was bigger than Tegan's bedroom. And then just had the blatant gall to say, so Tegan, why is your bedroom so small? You know, well, you know, that's just kind of how we're wired in some ways. Interesting twist of events in the last 6 weeks. The little girl who was, you know, kind of one-upping herself in a sense. Her family's had a stroke of bad luck. They've had to sell their home. They're renting. And she now has a bedroom comparable to Tegan's bedroom. So it'll be interesting to see how all of that goes. Except that our kids have had a little bit of good fortune, and they just bought a new home. And I swear, both kids' bedrooms are bigger than what Jim and I knew for about 20 years. I mean, so, you know, just watching this. Now, hopefully, Tegan will learn how to be more gracious in that conversation. But from the most little nonsensical things, you know, we are constantly in this comparison. Sometimes, it's good. I mean, we all should have individuals in our walks of life that we look up to and we admire and we say, you know, I would desire to someday be able to model what this person is modeling for me. But oftentimes, it's much more competitive and undermining. It's not that we're seeing the best. It's more that we're trying to one-up the other person around us, and it does no one any good. I mean, that's one reason why I have such difficulty, usually with gathering with pastors. And if you've read my schedule for this week, I'm going to a preaching conference this coming week. And one of the things I'm dreading is the socializing times. Because especially if you're a lead pastor or a solo pastor, I mean, you kind of gather with people that are sort of like interests. I mean, we have the same or like similarities in where we're at or what we're doing. And, you know, it's kind of disruptive and disturbing at times because we're so like the rest of you. You know, after you get past the little small talk and stuff about, you know, you finally get to the point, well, where are you serving? You know, and what's your church like a little bit? Then, you know, the next question is, how big is your church? And then, how big is their budget? So, you know, some of you are acquainted with me well enough to know that it's not unlike me to say something absolutely ridiculous to get them totally caught off guard and wonder what in the world is... I mean, I figure that if they're going to compare me to someone else, I might as well put myself in a league that they don't stand a chance. You know? Or I have the tendency to be like Jesus here and give a snip little remark that basically is saying, butt out, it's none of your business, my name is Romney Caddy. You know? Well, I've never heard of you before. Well, that's fine, I've never heard of you either. And then we just go forward from there. Then we're on the same ground and we can build a relationship. But isn't that true in so many things? I mean, I don't know how many times people beat themselves up because they feel like they're the inadequate parent. There's no parent that's perfect. There's, you know, there's so many things. So the question that comes to my mind is this. To what extent do you think you might be hindering God's ability to work through you by comparing yourself to someone else? If in the context of our faith, if you are so mindful of your deficiencies and always saying, well, you know, I could do this and I could do that and I could do whatever if I was only like this person, well, then you're not giving God a chance. The situation is, God, here I am. You know what I'm capable of better than I do. He invites us to follow him, invites us to walk with him. It's been said numerous ways, but I like this one because it expands on it a little bit and starts getting our heads being tweaked a little bit. This quote by Neil Maxwell, God does not begin by asking us about our ability, but only about our availability. And if we then prove our dependability, he will increase our capability. That's what it's all about. It's not about comparison. It's about what God can accomplish through each one of us. And it begins by just simply saying, I'm here. I'm here. I'm available. Those are the best words that God can ever hear from us. I'm available. If we can set aside our own personal agendas, we can go forward from there. Some of you have become somewhat familiar, the PNC is very familiar with what the Presbyterian tradition refers to as a resume. We call it a PIF, Personal Information Form. I hate the second narrative question. The second narrative question wants you to identify your preferences in ministry. If you read my PIF, it basically says, this is a stupid question. The question is not what my preferences in ministry are. The question is, where does God want me to serve now? And then in that context, I adapt and I change and I try to be who God desires for me in that context. I go on to say, it's not that I don't have preferences, but those are between God and me. The question is whether or not you feel I'm the person who should be serving you, and then I've got to adjust my attitude, my perspective, what I'm willing to do. I mean, you get into a conversation with me, I can tell you exactly what I prefer best in ministry. But that's not necessarily where God's going to place me, how God's going to use me. Some of you are already saying, so, how did we rate? I'll tell you how you rated. Very low on the scale. That's just the truth. What's my preference? At least 400 to 450 members, with at least one ordained person on staff full-time along with me, preferably two, because I like to work in a team environment. And I'm mindful of my own limitations. And I hate being by myself in ministry because I'm aware of what I can't do. I love working in an environment where I know we can meet as many needs as possible because there's a group of people around me. You know what? Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. All the doors open, here I am. I don't think I've ever served you with a bad attitude. You know, this is where God wants me to serve now. Great. Let's go for it, 100%. You know, that's where we need to be in our lives. Great illustration of this about 3 weeks ago. When the Warriors won their 73rd game, they now hold the title of winning the most games in a season of anybody. They're no longer tied with the Chicago Bulls. Got home, well, got to Heather's house one evening where I'd been staying at that point, and turned on the radio to 740, which I basically listened to get a quick catch-up. And I just stumbled on an interview, and they're interviewing Steph Curry about what all of this means. Well, you know where it's going to go right away, because, you know, the Bulls were at the top of their game under the years that Michael Jordan played the position that Steph Curry plays now. So the question comes, are you better than Michael Jordan? And I'm going, oh, this is going to be so interesting. And he's kind of hedging it a little bit. And the interviewer just won't let go of it. He wants that moment of comparison because you know whatever comes out of his mouth, it's going to be the talk of the radio and TV for the next 2 or 3 weeks. Everyone in that business has a job now because of what Steph says or doesn't say. Magnificent response. Michael Jordan was my childhood hero. Michael Jordan was fantastic. I still hold him in a great amount of esteem. But Michael Jordan and I have two different skill mixes. My skill mix is not Michael's. Michael's is not mine. I'm not supposed to become Michael Jordan. My responsibility on this team is to develop my skill mix to the very best of my ability. You know what? That was the end of the interview. The interviewer couldn't go any further. He just got shut down because this tabloid of comparison that he wanted to get into, it wasn't going to work. Don't get me into that game. And that's how we need to live out our lives as believers. We're not in a game of comparisons. We're in a game of each one of us responding to those words, follow me. What does it mean for you to follow Christ? What does it mean for me to follow Christ? I really began, it's not that I didn't know this or I wasn't aware of it, but there are certain messages that you hear or you read something and they just grab you at a point and you can't forget it. I can't remember hardly anything about the message whatsoever, but about 15 years ago, I had, at that time, the greater area representative of the Presbyterian Foundation at West Valley because we were in the process of trying to establish an endowment fund And we were associating ourselves to the Presbyterian Foundation, which is the oldest endowment foundation in the United States. It's over 200 years old. Some of you know the person who was on staff at that time and represented this area. I found out first service because all of a sudden people started saying, oh, I know that person. Oh, Skip Herberg. He used to be the pastor at First Presbyterian Church in Vallejo. And then he went to Sacramento, to Westminster Presbyterian Church before he went on the board of the foundation. His sermon was this: do you believe in Jesus, or are you following the Christ? His message had nothing to do about the endowment fund. It had nothing to do about finances. And I'm not saying that as a negative comment. I just found it so fascinating in a context where everyone was expecting him to say something different. He asked this very fundamental question that every one of us need to address in our lives day after day after day, not to beat ourselves up, but to be opening ourselves up to the availability of God working through us. Am I simply believing in Jesus, or am I willing to follow the Christ? That's a critical question for every one of us. Jesus says, even the devil believes in Jesus. Doesn't mean that he's willing to follow the Christ. And that's something we need to come to terms with. I'm not trying to discredit any passages in Scripture related to believing in Jesus and our salvation, but the critical issue is, are we giving God a chance to transform each one of us to the extent that he's able to work through us? And that only happens when we each respond to the same question that was given to Peter. Peter, follow me. Follow me. And you got to understand that when Jesus says those words to Peter, he never tells Peter what the task is going to be. He gives Peter a little bit of an insight in terms of how it's going to end, but Peter really basically doesn't have a clue of what's going to happen. The question is still there. Follow me, Peter. And when you look at those texts where Jesus uses that word, it's always in the context of, in the verbs, keep on following me. Keep on following me. Day after day after day. That's the reason why it's such a poignant question when Jesus says to his disciples in Luke 6:46, he says, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I tell you to? Isn't that a great question? Some of you are saying no. Wish you hadn't even brought it up. But, you know, that's the whole thing in John 14 and John 15. A masterful job of John recording Jesus' words on the correlation between loving and obeying. If you love me, you will obey me. None of us like to hear that. John 14:15, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. You go a little bit further in that, Jesus identifies the primary commandment he's concerned about. Love one another, even as I have loved you. That's where we start. That's where we start. Wow. Good stuff. Great stuff to know on. Something great to just have get into the gut of your soul to help keep you on course. What does it mean for me to be a follower of Christ? Going to try to put an image in your mind. Hopefully it'll be helpful. The message in which I got blasted for the most as being inappropriate during my 20 years at West Valley was this passage, John 14:15. If you love me, you will keep my commandments. It's not like everyone in the congregation reacted negatively, but man, I had some real vocal negative reactions because of my illustration. My illustration was this, that I never ever had come to terms with this passage in the manner in which I was coming to terms with at that point in my life until both of my kids were in their teens. And I was realizing that there wasn't one thing that either Jamie or I were asking them to do that was harmful for them. All of the intentions were for their well-being and for their good. And there were times when, on all honesty, when it was just, you know, that constant pushback, some of it that needed to be there as they found their old self, where I was going, you know, if you really loved me, you would just, for heaven's sakes, you would just do what I'm asking you to do. This is not the end of the world. It's for your good. And when those moments came and they blatantly did the opposite, it really challenged the core of my being in terms of, to what extent do you love me or not? And that really began to eat at me in terms of my relationship with God. What does it mean when I say I love you? Why am I resistant to your will? What needs to happen? What needs to change? What are the perspectives I need to come to terms with? I found out that as I grew older, even though I was responsible for myself, I've shared with people every once in a while, the most traumatic birthday I've ever experienced in my life was when my dad turned 72. And his birthday was the day before mine. I was in my car, I was driving home, and I don't know why the thought came to me, but this thought came out of the blue. It said, if your dad is 72, that must mean you're old enough to be a responsible adult. It just was there. But as I grew older, I found that even though I was a responsible adult and a family for which I was responsible, and those still those parent dialogues, unlike the years when I was a teenager and I was trying to establish my ground, I found my heart just kind of aching when I knew I was in a position that was juxtaposed to where my parents were. More than anything else, I wanted to be in harmony with them. I wanted to be in step with them. I was tired of the battle. I wanted to be the obedient son once, because I was beginning to get the grasp of this connection between love and obedience. And so I remember that week, the barrage of comments. How would you ever associate love and obedience between you and your children? Finally just got to the point where I said, read John 14 and 15, and then come back and tell me what you think. Just read it for yourself. You can write a better sermon on it than I just did, then you can have the pulpit next Sunday, but read it. Well, I don't know what this message will mean for you. I'm hoping that at least this part of it will stick in your gut the way it has stuck in my gut for a very long time. Because love and obedience and what does it mean to follow Christ? Man, that's at the core of the issue. It's really at the core of the issue. This week's takeaway: let us always be mindful that we are not called to merely believe and accumulate information, but to follow God's teachings and experience transformation. One message I won't give while I'm here, which I would love to give while I'm here, it just hasn't been appropriate, but you're going to get a tidbit because it fits right here, and that is this. The biggest mistake we make as Christians is we read our Bibles for information and not for transformation. I don't care if you can quote everything under the sun from the Bible. If it has not changed your life, it's not worth one iota. If you know one verse that has transformed your life, it's better than memorizing 100 that you only know because you've memorized them. Your relationship to God through Jesus Christ is all about transformation. It's not a denial of belief, but it's about transformation. What does it mean for you to follow Jesus? What does it mean for you to follow Jesus? Let's stand, sing our hymn as we prepare ourselves for communion.
You have been listening to Community Presbyterian Church Sermon Podcast. To learn more about Community Presbyterian Church and its ministries, come visit us at 2800 Georgia Street in Vallejo, California, or visit our website, cpcvallejo.org. You can also email us at cpcvallejo@sbcglobal.net. Have a blessed day.